Stornoway, 16 for Edinburgh, Belfast, Manchester and Cardiff, a high of 17 in Plymouth. Sunday, though, is a very different day. We're going to see wet and very windy weather spreading from the northwest, gusts of 50 to 60 miles per hour in places, which could cause some travel disruption, and there will be some really heavy rain as well. So a quiet day on Saturday, a very wet and windy day on Sunday. And that's all the weather for now.
That's Ben Rich. So now, on Radio 4, we reach the concluding part of our Book of the Week, Deep Sea and Foreign Going. Nearing the end of her time on board the freighter Kendall, the journalist Rose George hears of a dramatic rescue in the vessel's past as she reflects on the ever-present perils of the ocean. The reader is Susie Riddell.
It happened when Kendall was 15 days old. As the senior captain in Maersk's container fleet, Captain Glenn often took ships out from the yard. This time he was sailing from the shipyard in South Korea to Malaysia. The weather was poor, but as the captain wrote in the ship's log, the crew felt safe, comfortable and proud on their new vessel, the weather having little effect on such a large ship. On the 7th of August 2007, Kendall's bridge team began to hear messages about MV Palin Maritime, a Thai general cargo ship carrying 24 men and 4,700 logs that was in trouble. The ship was 30 years old and ill-kept. Captain Glenn, telling the story of Palin, calls the ship "this tired old girl." The tired old girl was listing heavily in the heavy seas. If she had been a motorbike, the rider's left knee would have been scraping the ground. That made it impossible to launch the port lifeboat when the ship was almost underwater. The crew could only jump into the water with life jackets and life raft pods. One crew member couldn't swim, wouldn't try, and went down with the ship. The rest took their chances in the warm seas, where some waves were 4 metres high. From the water they watched as the lights on Palin flickered, then failed. 15 minutes later, the ship had disappeared beneath the surface. They were left in darkness among furious seas, shark territory. What does the search part of search and rescue mean? It means looking, peering, staring at choppy seas, hoping to see something. It is tensing your eyes, screwing up skin, constantly straining. It is keeping the bridge windows wiped with the big windscreen wipers. It is binoculars for all in all directions. It is extremely difficult. Human eyes work best with things they can differentiate, a branch, a bollard. They are not built to look at endless water. When the German sail training ship Palmyra sank in 1957, 500 miles from the Azores Islands, its survivors in a life raft watched in amazement as a ship failed to see them, although it was only 300 feet away. The captain and his first officer needed to calculate where survivors might be. They knew they were on the right path when wreckage floated past later in the day, bits of blue plastic, some ropes. At 17:20, many large logs were seen in the water. 5 minutes later, a body went past, face down. The sight unsettled the crew, but the man was obviously dead, so the captain ordered the ship to carry on, in search of the living. 1.5 miles and 5 minutes later, the crew saw orange smoke, then a small rocket, though it was more of a damp squib. Imagine the hope behind that damp squib, the fierce and desperate hope. Later, one of the men in the water told the captain that they had made out, only just, Kendall's funnel. They only realised that they had been noticed because of the smoke. It meant that Kendall's engines were going astern. The ship was breaking. They had been seen. The crew in the rescue boat headed towards the site of that orange smoke, careful to stay as long as possible in the lee of the ship, inside an area that the ship's mast turned into a shelter. There were dark logs everywhere. The seas were blackening. And then suddenly there were two black heads in the black water among the black logs. The captain says they look like two black tyres in the water. In his log, the captain wrote, "Bingo." At 1803, they were hauled into the rescue boat. For all those hours in the water, they had fended off furious logs. Their chests were deeply bruised by hours of blows and assaults. Once the swell died down, there would have been sharks. Sitting in his comfortable cabin on Kendal, looking at a picture of the rescue crew, Captain Glenn is not at peace with Palin. What still bothers me to this day is the thought that when we picked up those two small heads in the water, what if there were four more heads further off who could see us because we had our lights on? They could see our ship and they would see us leave. That still bothers me. You don't read much about Merchant Navy heroism anymore, although it is common enough. For most of history, the seaman's life has been one of adventure, perhaps, but also of weevils, awful food, terrible weather, press gangs, pirates, the constant possibility of drowning or injury. Sea life was underpaid, underfed, and so often lethal that Marco Polo thought a man who went to sea must be a man in despair. Nor was there peace and harmony ashore. Sailors in a strange port were easy targets for exploitation. Dockland touts known as crimps abounded. They waited for sailors dockside. Most sailors wouldn't get their wages for a few days, leaving them with nothing to live on when ashore. You haven't been paid yet. Then have this gin, this woman, this boarding house bed on credit. It's no trouble. After 3 days of such underhanded open-heartedness, the sailor usually had a bill long enough to push him straight back onto a ship and out of the way of home. The crimps had names such as Dutch Charlie and Flash Tom. They were making the godless world of seafaring worse than it need be, so the Reverend Robert Buckley Burton, a seafarer's chaplain in Bristol, took action. He bundled sailors into a line of waiting cabs and took them to the station and to trains home. Police at the station helped the good Reverend oversee the purchasing of tickets and the delivery of seamen onto the trains. Victory was complete when the trains pulled out of the station and the crimps stood behind the railings shaking their fists. Accounts of early seamen's missions abound with tales of not obviously religious endeavours, such as chaplains sourcing a piano for a musical captain at short notice, or recruiting compliant, but not too compliant, young ladies for seamen's dances. The Seamen's Church Institute of New York's most famous employee was Mrs. Janet Roper, known to all as Mother Roper, well known for her efforts to match families with their lost seafarer relatives, and the other way round. Seamen were known for going missing, but Mother Roper located 200 a year on average. In 1934, she gave a radio interview, which ended like this. "Boys who are sailing out on the sea and listening in tonight, find for me Smokey Joe. His mother is dying. Pass the news to Punch Smith. His wife is seriously sick. Shorty Maguire has been looking for his wife and little boy for 10 years. Tell him I finally located his wife and little boy, and they want him back. Good night, boys. And see that you write your mother and your sweetheart once every month and let them know where you are. That's only fair play. Good night, boys." What resonates most from Mother Roper, from the archives of all the seafaring parishes, is a constant and unwavering kindness, offered in all weathers and all ports, and for no obvious gain. Father Colum Kelly arrived at Immingham, a port on the north-eastern coast of England, as a temporary chaplain for the Seafarers' Centre, on loan from his inner-city Catholic parish in Leeds. It was meant to be a 6-month loan, 8 years ago. Colum had no seafaring links. His family in Ireland is not a maritime one. After 30 years in city parishes, though, the secondment sounded like a break. The first step was to go to sea. Apostleship of the Sea training consists of taking a passage on the QE2. Colum's voyage was no sinecure. It was right after the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami, and the Thai crew were distraught when they watched the TV news and saw doors and bits of houses floating through their villages. It was his first exposure to the modern seafarer's predicament of quick information and eternal impotence. It was then that he understood. Even a seafarer on the most advanced, most expensive of ships may still need comfort. He still needs effective friendliness. Columns is a ministry of small gestures with great impact. A SIM card, a battery, a gift for a man who has spent yet another Christmas at sea. Often, seafarers tell him things they would not dare tell people they consider to be more official. He is a safe pair of ears. Once, he visited a ship at Immingham and the crew were silent and wouldn't look at him. This was striking. It is rare that he is not made to feel welcome. He left knowing something was seriously wrong, and that evening saw some of the crew in the centre, their day's work done. They saw him and began to cry. They told him, "We have just come through the Bay of Biscay in a Force 10, and we know our ship will sink when we go back that way. We know we will die." They begged him to help. They knew that he was in a special and delicate position. Mission chaplains must be careful about their role as human helpline. They cannot be seen to be snitches, or they might be refused access. But they have to be a comfort service that doesn't just provide woolens. Colum phoned someone he knew at the right authority, and the ship was officially inspected. A bilge pump, supposed to pump water out, had been put on backwards and was pumping water in. The ship would have sunk. But the crew didn't dare say anything on the ship. The captain had called them to the bridge and made them sign forms saying they were happy with everything. Colum shakes his head. It's sad, such exploitation. On Kendal, we have transported what needs to be transported, travelled 9,288 nautical miles through the wildest place on the planet, and done it safely and efficiently. Visitors begin to arrive up the gangway, the usual stream of port busybodies, and really by now I should have gone down it, but I dawdle. I don't want to leave the bridge and its windows, the boxes, the quiet nights at sea, the depth beneath. I don't want what Singapore has to offer, shops filled with choice and stuff, everything that we have been removed from on Kendal while carrying it. During her return trip, the captain emails. He wants to know whether my transition to land has gone well. He once gave me a few pages of his autobiography, full of the colour of his first 3 decades at sea. He concluded by writing to an imaginary cadet, wondering if he will have as good an experience as he did. He thinks so, because he will be mesmerised by the technology on the bridge. He will be shocked at the jaw-dropping huge main engine. He may find that every day could be an adventure. The captain must be feeling differently when he writes his email. "You can see how we are really thought of," he writes. "We are mere chattels, a human resource, dispensable non-entities." I wander around Singapore, dispirited. It is half docks, this port city, but the dock area is high security and closely guarded. The cranes, though, are tall enough to tower over the highway, and I look at them with wistful affection. I imagine them loading and unloading Kendal, swarming over her as she sits passively at the dock, having things done to her. The empty boxes will be exchanged for filled ones, sinking her further in the water with paint and Valium and chemicals and airbags. Thousands of moves, boxes taken and boxes put back, and at the end of it, Kendal will look exactly the same.
Susie Riddell reading the final extract from Deep Sea and Foreign Going by Rose George. The abridger was Lawrence Waring and the producer, Ellie McCready. Now, the book might be at an end, but we're staying at sea. The shipping forecast is coming up after sailing by. Thank you. BBC Radio 4. It's 12 minutes to one. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Saturday the 14th of September. There are warnings of gales in Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, Forties, Humber, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Fair Isle, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Low, southeastern England, 1,015. Expected German bite, 1,005 by 1800 Saturday. Low, 40s, 1,012, losing its identity by the same time. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. West Viking, northerly, backing southwesterly later, 5 or 6. Showers, good. East Viking, North Utsira, South Utsira, East 40s. Cyclonic 6 to gale 8, becoming northwesterly.